Good afternoon and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm joined in studio by J. Brooks Spector, Daily Maverick journalist. My name is Stilly Sharalambos, and we will be talking current affairs and all the good things being covered by the Daily Maverick. You can follow us on at Daily Maverick on Twitter. You can tweet us in studio at Cliff Central, cliffcentral.com. And you can follow us on our newsletters, either via Daily Maverick website or your daily dose with Cliff Central. Brooks, the first thing I'd like to chat about is the one topic that seems to be dominating international coverage over the last week, which is obviously the problems in Gaza, the rockets, the firing from both sides, and the civilian casualties that seem to be racking up some significant numbers in the problems that are going on there.
Yeah, well, I mean, the basic problem, that's not fair. There's a whole table's worth of basic problems, and that's actually the heart of it. I mean, it's an issue that's been going on for, where are we now? It's been going on for 70 years.
70 years.
It's not one that admits to an easy solution, and it stems from a whole series of historical circumstances in which there are no clear winners. If you want to talk about solutions, what you have now is what the area called the Gaza Strip was originally a portion of the UN partition plan for Palestine back in 1947-48, and it was the section in the southwest of the territory that the Egyptians managed to hold on to in the original Israeli War for Independence. Its population was not large at the beginning, but a fair number of Palestinian refugees moved across what became the ceasefire line and set up housekeeping there with the idea, of course, that eventually they would return, which, of course, they never have. Their numbers have grown. In the 67 and then in the 1973 wars, Israel managed to hold on to that area along with the West Bank and Sinai originally, and as part of the Israeli program of controlling that territory, a series of official settlements, as well as a number of unofficial ones, technically legal even under Israeli law, were set up. Then in the early 2000s, I think it was 2006, if I'm not mistaken, the Israelis insisted on withdrawing, the Israeli government insisted on withdrawing those settlements as part of a movement toward what was presumed to be a eventual process of a larger settlement. The larger settlement, of course, has never happened. The area in Gaza, which is a terribly densely populated area now, the original inhabitants of it, as well as the Palestinian refugees.
It's something north of 4 million.
About in Gaza itself, somewhere about 1.5 million plus. But the population has increasingly accepted the political doctrines of Hamas, which is effectively affiliated with Hezbollah, another group that operates in the north to some considerable degree. They have advocated a non-acceptance of Israel as a state. They've advocated an effort to change the geography, if you will, by force. The Israelis, of course, have resisted that idea in its entirety, and Hamas has been labeled a terrorist organization by the U.S., by Israel, and a number of other states. The immediate proximate cause of the latest unpleasantness was the kidnapping and eventual killing of three Israeli teenagers, and Israel's efforts to determine who did it, where they were, and to bring them to capture or, in simple terms, to kill them.
How does that translate into what we saw were aerial strikes at, you know, what seemed to be civilian targets,
yeah,
you know, that were claimed to be, I mean, precision strikes, and we've seen something like 80 civilians being killed.
Well, there is no such thing as ultimately a precision strike. Precision strikes always have what they euphemistically term collateral damage. Mm. Collateral damage usually means dead people. Mm. The Israeli Defense Force obviously decided that this was a good opportunity both to enact revenge for the killing of the three teenagers, but in a larger way to punish Hamas and make it incapable of conducting any other kinds of activities or opportunities. Now, the folks in Hamas decided in retaliation to launch a series of rockets aimed at Israel itself. These weren't effectively very highly technologically advanced rockets, these M75.
Sort of handheld type.
Well, they're a little better than that, and there is a further model that effectively, if you look at the target range, they can reach most of the main population centers in Israel, whether it be Haifa, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem. And the problem is this becomes an enormously painful tit-for-tat exercise. The Israeli Defense Force using, again, what they think of, what we like to define as precision weapons, has targeted the places where the rockets are fired. Hamas, for its part, because it is numerically and obviously technologically and militarily the inferior, has taken to launching these rockets from buildings which are apartment buildings or houses, schools, whatever, effectively using the people in the immediate area as a shield against the retaliation in return. That inevitably has led to, I think the latest count, something like 168 fatalities. When you compare it, say, to what's happened, the terrible things that have happened in Syria in the last couple of years, this is 1/1,000th of the level.
Thousands of people have
closing in on 200,000 deaths and 3 or 4 million internal and external refugees, which is a cataclysmic event for a society. This is in the nature of an enraging event. Now, you know, for every family that has lost somebody, obviously it's a personal catastrophe, but it isn't the kind of existential moment for a society. The bottom line, of course, is the Israeli Defense Force can contain Hamas, but it can never get rid of it, because the more casualties you have, the more recruits you get to the Hamas cause. Hamas, of course, cannot possibly conceive of eliminating the Israeli Defense Force. The forces are so asymmetrical in strength that's beyond the counting of it. But what it does guarantee is you have two very sullen sides that have not figured out a way to solve their larger question of where they coexist in the universe.
Has it been surprising at all that Egypt has led the brokering of what we hope will be a ceasefire that will be announced today?
No, I was actually waiting for somebody, either Egypt or Jordan, or perhaps even another party. It's difficult to determine who else it might have been. But Egypt, of course, has a very strong vested interest in containing the violence in that region. It's the only other state with a border on the Gaza Strip. It itself has had a growing number of violent, uncontrollable, bands, I guess, operating in the Sinai Peninsula. It's become something of a no-go zone for tourists, for example, much of the Sinai, which is a serious revenue killer as far as Egypt is concerned. The particular kind of government that is in Egypt now, this military government that's making occasional mutterings in the direction of the restoration of democracy, follows in effect the Husni Mubarak line of having a cold peace with Israel. Not a warm embrace, obviously, but not a lack of recognition, a lack of relationship that some of the other Arab states continue to have with Israel. The Egyptian government is very clearly leaning in the direction of containing violence because it can be contagious to its own society. And that is in effect the real reason why the Egyptians have put forward this peace initiative. Latest news says the Israelis have accepted it. There hasn't been any word yet from Hamas, but I would expect that in the next day or two or three, you will see a similar kind of response, so that yet another ceasefire will take place along with all the other ceasefires that have preceded it.
in a war of attrition that's been going on for 70-odd years, what is it that needs to happen in order for a resolution to be found to a problem such as this?
We were talking about this just before we went on air, and I mean, it seems to me that everybody involved has to, at some point, and the key phrase is at some point, decide that the costs of continuing this are larger than the benefits from it. I mean, somebody said once that all wars eventually must end. That doesn't mean the same thing as all social or political conflicts end, but it means the actual hostilities have to come to an end in some way. What kind of vision can you see for this? Well, Hamas technically has joined with the PLO to form a coalition that is under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority that is in effective control of the West Bank territories, or much of it anyway. But effectively, Hamas operates as an independent kind of entity because their position vis-a-vis the Israelis is very different than the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah on the West Bank. So it's going to be a while yet.
Does it need to get worse before it gets better?
That, unfortunately, is my prescription for this, that there has to be a large enough cost that at some point people say enough. And I'm not convinced it's going to happen, certainly in the next little while, because this particular bit of conflict was not nearly painful enough for either side.
Yeah, not the most uplifting of news coming out of Gaza, or unfortunately the other topics that we're probably going to be covering today.
It's a cheerful day,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very cheerful day. I'd like to talk to you about the passing of Nadine Gordimer, someone that you met and knew personally, and that you had the opportunity to engage with over, you know, quite a long period of time. And when was the first time you met the late Nadine Gordimer?
It's a shock to me too. 1975.
Wow. That's a couple of years before I was born.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Tell me about that first experience.
She passed away on Sunday evening at the age of 90. And fortunately, if there is such a thing as fortunately when you talk about the passing of anybody, she passed away peacefully in her sleep. And that, you know, that's a blessing in a way. She was an absolutely redoubtable presence in literary terms. 15 novels, dozens of short stories, dozens more occasional pieces of literary criticism, political analysis, or the merger between politics and literature, guest lectures by the score around the world, and a Nobel Prize and a Booker Prize, along with all the other things that are listed in her CV.
And very much a natural talent.
Yeah, well, I mean, she went to university for a year. She went to Witz in the late 1940s for 1 year, decided it wasn't for her, and then basically went off and taught herself literature, taught herself the ability to analyze, and followed what I assume to be her natural predilections toward support for what was then obviously the underdog in this society. Early on in her life, she was part of the kind of bohemian lifestyle and circumstances in that small gray area in this country, even in the 1940s and 50s, where black and white met as relative equals in literary and political terms, left-wing politics, avant-garde literature, a society that existed in just a part of Johannesburg. But she counted among her friends people like the rising young talent of Nat Nakasa, somebody we talked about a few weeks ago, and Nelson Mandela, among many, many others. Her first novel, first full published novel, came out really early in her life. She was still in her 20s, The Lying Days, and she'd already sold short stories to the New Yorker magazine in the United States by then. And this is someone who was still well before the age of 30. She was one of these people who, unusually for the literary world in South Africa, took young black writers seriously, and they responded in kind. She would show up at a colloquium or a seminar or a conference or a meeting and just sort of glide in gently and sit down quietly. If it was winter, she was wearing a black cloak. She was about 5 feet one, which is what, a meter and less than a meter and a half, I guess. So she was not a very large physically imposing person, but she created this sort of column, a presence around her, even though she was almost a diminutive person, with this piercing stare. And if you were a fool or a knave or a silly person, the look from her would basically carve you into small pieces. But if she thought she detected the right kind of humanity or a spark of some sort of talent, she took the time to carefully and slowly engage with you.
You had a little bit to play in the awarding of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Nadine, tell us about that.
It was an interesting story. I was the U.S. cultural attaché in South Africa at the time, and one morning I'm sitting at work, literally doing whatever one does with the mail in the morning, and I got a phone call from a fairly embarrassed Scandinavian-sounding voice. Excuse me, could you help us? We need to talk to somebody in the American embassy. Now, considering the times, 1991, that can only be bad news. Something else terrible has happened in this country. You know, some dreadful massacre or something has occurred.
It's like a phone call in the middle of the night. It's never good news.
Yeah, and nobody calls you at 2 in the morning to say congratulations. Right. You've won the lottery. And I said, yes, and what is it that you need from us? And he said, well, we've gotten a telegram from the Swedish Academy. That's the body that hands out the Nobel Prizes for Literature. And they've asked us to find Nadine Gordimer and ask and let her know that she's won the Nobel Prize and make sure she's going to accept it. Now, some people have turned it down, in fact. Boris Pasternak was forced to turn it down in the early 1960s, if you remember. Soviet Union said, no, you will not receive this prize. And so they had become rather more cautious about this, making sure that the awardee actually says, oh, great, thank you very much. I'd love to take the medal. And so the Swedish voice on the other end, the deputy ambassador of the Swedish embassy said, we've called her house and she's not there. And the housekeeper says she's gone away. And we think she's maybe in America. Can you help us? And I happened to know where she was. She was staying with her son, who was a filmmaker living in New York City. And I said, yes, I think I can. And we scruffed around and found a Manhattan telephone directory and looked him up. And there weren't too many Hugo Cassirers in New York City, obviously. And I said, here's the phone number. Call her there. But remember, it's like 6 hours early. Don't call her at 2 in the morning. That will be awkward for everybody. Wait till it's sunrise, at least. You know, give her a chance to get up and have a cup of coffee. And by the way, when you have this huge party of congratulations, see if you can send us an invitation, too. We'd like to come since we helped you out just a bit. And that was a fun moment when you realize that an entire major historical thing is passing right through. And you're the only person at that precise moment who actually has the key to open the door.
Great anecdote there from the past. What was her, I mean, obviously a lot of her works were focused around the struggle around apartheid and obviously, you know, being aligned with the ANC's, struggle for liberation. Tell me about her works post-apartheid. I mean, because there were some criticisms leveled against her that, you know, her works hadn't really moved on from that central theme that sort of defined her, and maybe that was the problem. It's like that one big hit movie that, you know, that makes you the world-renowned person that you are, then, you know, you're kind of sort of stuck in a genre.
Yeah, the sort of now what do you do business.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the question in the arts always was, post-94, okay, now that apartheid's gone, now what do we do?
Now that we don't have this unifying central monster to fight against, you know, what do we do?
And I there were people who said that her historical moment in literature had passed and the rest of it was just filing. But I mean, I tend to disagree. The big books that came out later, the House Gun, I'm sorry, I can't, I'm drawing a blank on the other two. but the most recent novel.
No Time Like the Present.
Thank you. You're looking at the article, aren't you? Yeah. Which I managed to leave in the car. No Time Like the Present, which was the last novel. It actually, I think, was a perfect representation of the way we live now as a society in this country. The book talks to a racially mixed couple, a neighboring couple that's a gay partnership, a variety of other young professionals in a suburb that sounds rather dramatically like West Dean or Melville or perhaps Observatory in Johannesburg. And the book stutters and halts and hesitates. And that was actually to me a perfect metaphor for the way such people are trying to figure out the pace of their life and where they fit. And so, I mean, I disagree with critics who said that the big moment had passed, the time was over. She was now trying to figure out, what do these folks do now? What do South Africans do now that one historical event is history, 20 years gone? And what do they do now? And where do they go now? What are their answers? And I think she had been so good at creating this veritable universe populated by by heroes and knaves and fools and smart people, blacks, whites, Jews, Gentiles, you know, young, old, city folks, cowards and brave people, that this kind of book to me was this wonderful capstone on the way she had described the universe and then dragged it in, kicking and screaming almost, into the 21st century.
Of all the works, was there one that stood out more than the others?
Well, for me, the one, it's not her most consequential book, but it's the one that I always go back and reread. It's this little short novel, I mean, 150, maybe 200 pages at a stretch, July's People. And it came out in 1981. It was a couple of years past the Soweto Uprising, before the real impetus of the state of emergency, but you could see clearly that the society was no longer going to go on as before. And what it did was it looked briefly into the future, into a foreseeable future. What happens when the Civil War actually breaks down and civil order collapses and the reversal of roles, the pleasant, liberally inclined white suburban family is now thrown at the mercy of their housekeeper and the houseman, actually, who takes them to his village off in the northern Transvaal somewhere, and they are now totally dependent on him for life itself.
As much as we'd like to move on to a more uplifting topic.
Please.
Yeah, we'd love to. We're going to cross live to Marianne Tam, who's our associate editor in Cape Town, to tell us a little bit about an article she wrote following the Emeritus Archbishop Desmond Tutu's article that came out in The Observer in favor of euthanasia. Marianne, hello.
Hi. There?
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Marianne, you've done a lot of research into where the Archbishop's change in thinking has come about from. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what's interesting is that there's been a kind of low-level debate and discussion around issues of assisted dying that has been around since the 1990s, when Nelson Mandela initially commissioned the Law Commission to do a report on end-of-life decisions. The report was completed as Report 82, and it went to part was handed to the Minister of Justice. And I think at the time what was happening was there was a huge debate in South Africa about abortion, which at that point, you know, was incredibly contentious and had elicited hugely controversial responses from the South African public, who were not quite ready to talk it through, but we talked it through, and now that has become legislation. But I think the terminology around end-of-life decisions is what made it controversial at the time. The words like euthanasia, assisted suicide, which in a sense don't help the discussion, I think made it too much of a contentious issue. And so the legislation disappeared. And the issue sort of came to the fore again when Sean Davison went to New Zealand and as we know, he's assisted his mother to die. And it flared up in discussion at that point, and Sean eventually was given a prison sentence, house arrest, and eventually returned to South Africa after a plea by Bishop Tutu. So I think Bishop Tutu has been aware of the debate and the discussion for many years, but I don't think, you know, like most of us who are not in that situation at all, who are not dealing with somebody who's terminally ill or who don't have a terminal illness ourselves, we don't think about these matters until they become personal. And I think as Bishop Tutu has grown older, and then the country itself watching our beloved President Mandela linger on life support, I think has presented us all with a unique new opportunity where we are ready to have this discussion about the last human right, which is the right to choose to die with dignity. And that's kind of, those are the currents locally in which the Archbishop made his comments. But he did do them overseas because there's a big debate happening in the House of Lords in the UK. This is an issue that's been debated globally for many years now.
Where is the legislation at the moment? You're saying it disappeared, but it's sort of been lost in the works. No one knows. Fallen by the side.
No one knows. Professor Willem Landman of the Ethics Institute of South Africa has done quite a bit of writing around the Act itself. It's available for people online, and if you go to the Daily Maverick story, there's a link to it, and you can read it comprehensively. It's a very good piece of legislation. Of course, it needs to be debated. Some say it's lying on a shelf somewhere in the Department of Health. Others say that it's got caught up in the Department of Justice. It would be quite nice if someone within the ruling party or somebody in the opposition could actually find a way of getting it back on the table to be discussed.
So at the moment, it is currently illegal to assist someone in the ending of their own lives.
Yes, it is. It is. But if you look at the story as well, it's quite interesting because the law, the new law, as it has been written out, allows for people to be able to just, you know, see where they're not loopholes, but ethically where it is possible to do so. If you look at the Medical Protection Society of South Africa or South African Medical Society's recommendations to people, you see that there is confusion there where they say that a patient's advance directive must be honoured in a way, but legally that might be problematic. And then there are other issues, like we think that if we hand power of attorney over to somebody else before we become critically ill or before we are unconscious, that person then has the right to make decisions on our behalf. But it doesn't. Legally, at the moment, power of attorney falls by the wayside once you have lost consciousness or you become demented. So there's a lot of problematic issues. And what activists in this realm are trying to do at the moment is separate some of the issues around dying from assisted dying itself. So, for example, an advance directive needs a separate piece of legislation in order to make it very clear to those who draw them up and those who need to implement them what that means. But assisted dying is an entirely different subject. So these are issues that are very complicated that we need to sort out because, in a sense, by reaching some sort of stuck in some sort of stalemate doesn't help. Doctors are dealing with these issues every day. People are dealing with these issues. There are growing voices internationally that are calling for the right to die with dignity. And so the time has come to speak about it. And the Archer's wonderful statement, I think, has catapulted it back onto the national agenda.
Because we are hearing incidents of what's either happening is that people are being able to be assisted in their lives and obviously doing that illegally, and it is happening, and there are reports, and you know, there have been some call-ins to radio stations where we've had people who've been there actually pushing the button on helping a loved one to pass on, or in other cases where people are having to revert to crude ways of taking their own lives by trying to commit suicide, taking pills, using other methods.
Well, I mean, that's exactly. I mean, I had written a book for the Skudasiffel family about a year and a half ago. Their son Craig, and coincidentally, you know, it was the Archbishop read Craig's book and was inspired by his story, very much inspired, and I was too. I mean, Craig was 28 years old. He was diagnosed with neurofibromatosis type 1. Or von Recklinghausen's disease, which is very variable genetically, but he suffered his entire life with these unbelievable growths which were happening inside his body and outside. It's called these filaments that would wrap themselves around his intestines and these nodules that would grow on his skin. And the more surgery he had, the more it would grow. And he tried really hard for 28 years. Craig was a committed Christian. He tried for 28 years to deal with and live with this debilitating illness. And towards the end of his life, the last year of his life, it just got worse. And the prognosis for his long-term survival was bleak. And he wanted to leave while he was still compos mentis, before he lost all sense of himself and went for months and months of spiritual counseling, psychological counseling. He really did try and grapple with what it meant to take his own life, and it's agonizing to read his diaries and his letters and his emails to friends and family who were all drawn into it. And in a space where there's absolutely no legal guidance or any kind of guidance, people were afraid of entering the discussion. So you can imagine the anguish of this young man, this beautiful young man with this illness that's killing him. He applies to Dignitas in Switzerland, which is the only sort of clinic internationally that allows foreign nationals an assisted suicide. It offers an assisted suicide. But they turned him down. And I think that might have been because of his age. And because they weren't really, I think you need numerous doctors' reports, and one particular doctor had seen Craig. And, you know, doctors too are influenced by the climate and by what they feel ethically and religiously and everything else. And so without clear guidelines, Craig had to take his own life, and he wanted to die in his parents' arms. They, as shattered as they were, supported him in that decision. It took him a long time to get there, but they did. And they said they would want to do that with him, but instead he died alone. They tried once, and he took, I think, 47 sleeping tablets, but survived that attempt, which his family had to deal with. And then he managed to kill himself on the 1st of September 2009. But that was not the way Craig wanted to die. And I think reading a voice from someone who is no longer here and who was desperate for the opportunity to have his own, to end his own life, is what also I think if one reads the book, you I ask the question in it, how would you like to die if you were Craig? What would you do?
So where do we go from here? What needs to happen in order for the legislation to pick up steam, pick up support, and for it to be debated again, for us to get guidance and to get legal practices in place?
Well, I think first of all, we need to understand that we need to place the debate firmly within the legal framework. That doesn't mean we must disregard cultural and religious perspectives of it, but it is a human rights issue. It is not a religious, cultural issue, although, as I say, those questions are important. People who have religious beliefs that are against assisted dying are quite welcome not to participate in it, but those people who believe that we have the right to end our lives with dignity should be allowed this opportunity. I think what needs to happen now is we need to find a way of getting a groundswell in South Africa, and I think Nelson Mandela's lingering and the questions the family had to face around turning off life support have offered us a new entry point into the discussion, which I think several years ago we were not ready for. South Africans are quite mature when it comes to discussing rights now, which we might have been quite frightened of in the past. So we need a groundswell of voices that are not hysterical, voices that don't divert the debate, and we need politicians, leaders to somehow pick up the issue over and above. I mean, we cannot underestimate Bishop Tutu's statement as a religious leader. It's a very important one because this is one I think many religious people grapple with, many. And many have come out in support of assisted dying. Those who work with the dying and who know what it's like understand these ethical religious issues and have talked them through. So we need a groundswell of public activism. Dignity South Africa is very good at doing that. We need other voices to join the debate. And we need, as I say, we need to find that piece of legislation, and it needs to be re-entered as a act. It's an act that we debate and that gets passed.
Marianne Tam, Associate Editor of the Daily Maverick, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your views and your work on this topic.
Thank you.
Cheers. Brooks, we're about to cross live to Greg Nicholson, who's at the Farlam Commission, following the commission there closely for us. Natim Tetwa is on the stand. What do you make of his comments yesterday on the while testifying in front of the commission?
It was a very curious kind of testimony. He took responsibility without taking responsibility, in effect. Mm-hmm. And I'm really torn by the way everybody has effectively danced away from the crucial question. I mean, the most important question: who gave the orders down this chain of command, and how did they become, how did these orders from maintain order to fire at will, where were the crucial breakdowns in the command and control of this system? And I mean, if there's one thing that's ever going to happen out of this commission in its agonies over the last year and a bit, it's going to be to clarify just how you make these kinds of decisions and what kinds of obligations are incumbent on the people who do it and what kinds of sanctions are inflicted on them for doing it wrong. And that, to me at least, so far, remains thoroughly and sadly unclear.
We're going to try and cross live right now to Greg Nicholson, who's covering the commission for the Daily Maverick. Greg, are you there?
I'm here. How's it going, Stewie?
I'm great, thanks, Greg. What's going on there today?
Today, the second day of the cross of the testimony of Natiem Tetwa, the former police minister, now arts and culture minister. And obviously, he's one of the big witnesses to testify at the Marikana Commission, as he was the political head of the police at the time of the killings in August 2012. And the day started out, it's been quite a tense day. It started out with advocate Nsebeza, who represents some of the deceased families, showing a video of Natiem Tetwa on the 17th, the day after the killings happened on the 16th. Him and National Police Commissioner Ria Pieja, and they were congratulating the police officers. They were congratulating them for their bravery, for their nation building efforts, and for their courage in confronting these striking mine workers. And Nsebeza, he put it to the now Arts and Culture Minister that why are we congratulating these guys when in the week before, or in those days, they killed 37 people. And he compared it to the Sharpeville massacre, the Bishore massacre, and which were then in those condemned by the ANC. And he said what the deceased, the family members of the deceased want is for the government to condemn this massacre or these deaths. The term massacre is a little bit controversial, but these deaths, just like they would any other in the past. And Natiem Tetwa, he's been a bit, he won't condemn it, but he says obviously it was a tragedy. But he says what happens now is that, unlike these massacres in the past, the government has decided to put a commission to investigate. But really, the day belongs to Advocate Dalia Mpofu, the EFF commissar, and obviously has a bit of a controversial and very public profile. But he's been grilling Natiem Tetwa all day, and they've faced off. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. They've faced off on both sort of saying each other's versions are fabrications and figments of their imagination, and it's been quite heated. What Mpofu is trying to establish is he's arguing that Natiem Tetwa was the conduit, he says, between political pressure from Cyril Ramaphosa, who was board member of Lonmin at the time, who's obviously now deputy president of the country, and passing that political pressure on to the police heads, the national commissioner and the provincial commissioner, which then they passed that on. The political pressure went down right down to the officers on the ground, and that's what led to the killings. So that's been really what the day has been focused on today.
Greg, I'm not sure if you heard Brooks's comments as we were crossing, just before we crossed to you, that there seems to be difficulty, or whether it's by design or not, it's a difficulty in assigning who gave the orders, that changed it, as it went down from the top down to the people on the ground, ultimately assigning responsibility for what happened. And in that context, does it feel to you like the commission seems to be a concerted effort to drag this out for as long as possible without getting to that place of accountability and ultimate responsibility where, blame can be laid at someone's door for what happened, so that we almost forget about the seriousness of what happened, and that it's a delay tactic in some way by those concerned to sort of, weasel the way out of holding someone accountable.
I think if we're talking about police, like who ordered the police officers to pull the triggers, the cops would be very happy, and most of the state involved would be very happy, I think, if the commission was wrapped up a lot earlier. And now we're seeing it actually being quite hurried. They've got a new finish date of, I think, 30 September. But so in terms of who's responsible and if anyone will own up to giving the order to pull the triggers, at least at the first scene or at the second scene where police are accused of hunting down the mine workers, No one's owned up to ordering anyone to pull the triggers. What has come up through, I guess, the month, almost year and a half now, I think, of the commission, is that these police officers, this is the argument from the SAPS, is that they were acting in self-defense. And in such situations, sometimes they do have the individual prerogative to be able to pull the trigger themselves if they see lives, their own lives are under direct and imminent threat, or the lives of others. And that's sort of what they've been claiming. There were officers on the ground who told them to stop firing, and they didn't stop firing. That's clear from the videos we've seen. But it's clear that no one's going to own up, and no one is owning up to telling the other officers to open fire.
As well as the incidents that happened at the second copy, because a lot of the video footage shows what happened up mm-hmm. before the incidents at the second copy, as obviously documented by Greg Marinovich's groundbreaking article.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right.
Go ahead, Greg.
I was going to say, the second copy is it's a lot murkier. The police officers have sort of used the same argument that they were trying to round up the protesters, and they pursued them after they fled the scene because they wanted to arrest them, disperse them, and disarm them. That was their key goal. It's important that they wanted to arrest them as well. They wouldn't just let them run away because there is this attitude that they wanted to sort of punish these guys who were in violation of the law by having violent weapons. Some of them supposedly had guns, but many of them had pangas and whatnot. But they say when they were trying to chase them down, that then again these mine workers charged at them and attacked them, which from the evidence that we've seen, that's quite unlikely. But there's no one who we've seen is owning up to ordering direct fire at the first or second copies.
Greg, you've been following the commission quite closely for us. What do you think will be the ultimate outcome once this commission is wrapped up?
It's, to be honest, it's really hard to say. And that's very interesting what we're seeing today in the broader consequences of why the police were in the place they were in, why they had live ammunition, why their plan was so pathetic. So we're looking at the bigger sort of political influences that happened. And that could be quite interesting to see whether when Farnham, who heads the commission, and his team write their report, whether they decide to lay any blame at the feet of the politicians who it suggested worked with Lonmin and the National Union of Mine Workers to collude and crack down on this strike and perhaps push a plan that wasn't well thought out, that wasn't implemented at the right time, even if it was a good plan, and also to exert undue pressure or undue violence that wasn't necessary. But I don't think there's evidence to show that yet. We still have to see Cyril Ramaphosa come to the commission at the end of the month. I don't think they're really going to at least suggest criminal charges against any of these sort of bigger political or bigger police sort of heads. I think, it's still hard to say, but I think what we might end up seeing is the Farnham pointing out a lot of the problems that happened and systemic sort of suggestions as to how we can improve public order policing without really laying the blame directly and squarely at anyone's feet.
Greg Nicholson, reporting live from the Farnham Commission for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Cheers. Brooks, we've covered some pretty heavy topics today. I'd like to end off with something a little bit lighter, a really good play that surprised you recently, musical, stroke play, stroke, you know?
Controlled Chaos.
Controlled Chaos, yeah.
This is the musical Spamalot. It's ripped out of the heart of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which was a film. Sort of a cult film. If you like Monty Python, you love Monty Python and the Holy Grail. If you didn't like Monty Python, you had absolutely no idea what was happening on in the film. But the play's on at the Joburg Theater, what used to be the Civic Theater now, and it will run through August 13th, I think. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's absolutely mindless entertainment in the best meaning of the word, because it's clever, and there's sleight of hand, and there are in jokes, and then there are jokes about the jokes, and it is in the most ephemeral kind of way based on the legend of King Arthur, the Holy Grail, and the Lady of the Lake. And the Lady of the Lake is a frustrated Bernadette Peters, and King Arthur is a thoroughly feckless man who can't seem to raise an army to find the Holy Grail, which turns out to be a can of spam. And on like that. It goes on for close on to 2 hours, and the songs are fun. You aren't going to go home whistling the songs, but you're going to enjoy them while you hear them. And the cast, they're like two dozen people on the stage, and between them they probably play 60 different characters, and they've managed to create individual personas for each of those little bits. And it's a thoroughly ensemble kind of thing. But in a way, I think the real standout at the play is Bongi Mtombeni, who plays Patsy, King Arthur's horse, among other things. It's a very strange horse who actually operates with two coconut shells, and he's a King Arthur's straight man, except he gets all the best jokes.
Wow. And this has come off a successful run overseas, I believe.
Oh yeah, it got Tony Awards in the U.S. and it's been a great favorite of people who've gone to see it. It's not quite like the Rocky Horror Picture Show where you go back and you see it 10 times and show up in your fishnet tights. Mm-hmm. But it's moving in that general direction. I mean, people who like it lots. And my wife and I both, we had a good laugh. It had been a long week, and this was just the right tonic.
Is there anything else currently on the circuit that you could recommend for theater goers?
I mean, this right now is, to me, the pick of things that are on stage. If you didn't see John Connie's Missing at the Market Theater, you missed an enormously important event. It's bound to come back, but it just finished up this past weekend. But running right now is something called the 969 Festival, which is a collection of the best or most interesting works that are available from the Grahamstown Festival, which just closed. And all of these take place at the various parts of the Vitz Theater this week and through the weekend. And I think on the 17th, which is 2 days from now, Kyle Shepherd performs with his trio. And Kyle is an absolute, he's too old to be a prodigy, but if prodigy could sort of slide over into your mid-20s, that would be just right. The man is an absolute master of the jazz piano. He's found his own individual and unique style, and he's really, really mining that vein.
He was your standout performer at the Grahamstown Arts Festival, wasn't he?
Right. No, I enjoyed that immensely, sufficiently to go out and buy the CD immediately afterwards, the double CD. And I'm going to make a point of trying to see him again. This is a guy who, yes, he was trained in university, but he's managed to find all the different elements that go into making up South African jazz and music history more generally, right back to ancient sort of timeless son melodies and ideas, and picking up the styles of the Cape, the marching band, the organ sounds of the churches, the muezzin calling from the minaret even. And he's taken it all, put it through his own personal meat grinder, and come up with a new way of listening and then reusing all this material, as well as borrowing and appropriating and making intelligent use of all the new concepts in jazz, from cool jazz all the way through to the kind of experimental use of sound and silence that people do.
I wanted to ask you, as someone who's intimately involved in theater in South Africa and Johannesburg, what's the state of the South African scene, stage productions? I mean, we've seen these big shows coming to South Africa, being sold out, having extended runs, opening, going down to Cape Town. What's the current state?
The challenge for theater people, the producers, directors, actors, it's two challenges, really. One is the way of figuring out how to make money out of this business, mm-hmm. sufficient to keep yourselves alive and healthy. And the other is finding that secret thing that an audience is going to respond to with great enthusiasm and embrace as something that speaks to them personally. Coming up shortly from Cape Town is Athel Fugard's last play, the Song of the Hummingbird, which will almost certainly be the final play in his creative writing life. He's in his 80s now, and it's clear this was a long time in coming. But audiences are always kind of fickle in this country, if for no other reason than there isn't one single theater-going audience. It's very much different niches in the audience. People like things other people don't like. people enjoy a particular style and other people run away from it. The facilities are around now. I talked to somebody the other day who's busy trying to build a business plan to rehabilitate and put back into use the wonderful old Alhambra Theater over in, what neighborhood is that precisely? Is it Yeovil or Dornfontein, somewhere right at that border point? It's a wonderful old building, and it hasn't been used for a number of years. Then the Market Theater has undergone and it's still actually undergoing a major renovation. The Joburg Theater has spaces. Monte Cassino has that even larger set of spaces. The problem is finding the work where people feel if they haven't gone to it, if they haven't seen it, they're missing a major moment in their lives. And that's become a little harder. The best thing I've seen in a very long time in terms of serious theater was Missing. This was, as I said, the work that John Conte wrote. And it talked to the issue of exile and return. And the problem is this really comes home to lots of people, but then the people who never went into exile or for whom it would never have occurred to them, this can be something of a daunting exercise to embrace. So that becomes a particular niche. The other works that come here, the big imported musicals find their audience among families that want something that's good for the children. The Sound of Music was the perfect thing to take your 7-year-old niece to. It may not have been precisely what you wanted to see yet again.
But still found yourself singing along to half the...
You had no choice because it's been burned into your consciousness, all those songs. So you walk out of the theater going, do a deer, if you can't, and you can't help yourself. But theater really is in a bit of flux here, partly because the effects of the enormous political, social, cultural change and economic changes that have swept over the country in the last 20 years only now really working their way into the consciousness of theater makers. And I'll just end with one little footnote. Aubrey Sacabi, and I haven't seen the work yet because it doesn't open at the State Theater for another month or so, but it was a hit in Grahamstown after I had left, was unbelievably Marikana the Musical.
Yeah. Brooke Spector, thank you so much for joining us today in studio for the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm Stelly Sharalambos. We're on every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Please do join us next week. Thank you.
CliffCentral.com.